Welcome to the CBS Sports Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Moore. On the line with me is James Herbert at Outside the NBA, who went to a concert last night, got out, and found out that the Raptors had actually been ejected from the NBA. They have been removed. The Toronto Raptors are no longer an NBA franchise.
Well, actually, I knew what was happening before. Like, I think the Raptors were already down by like 30 by the time the show started. Like, that's how quickly everything got out of hand. It was like, I was looking at the score and I was like, okay, yeah, this makes sense. Like, the Raptors are one of these teams that, like, when they're at their best, like, they look like they can beat anybody. And when they're at their worst, they just look like absolute garbage. Like, I did go back and watch it after, and it was just right from the opening tip. I mean, maybe the first like 3 minutes they had some energy. And then when they like got stonewalled a few times, trying to make something happen on offense, it just, the wheels came off so fast and they never really managed to do much of anything after that. It was crazy.
This is another series where I don't know if my hot takes are hot takes, because like what I really walked away with from last night is I was finally like let it out the bag, because I've been thinking it for months and didn't want to say it. Chris Middleton, like DeMar DeRozan, only good. That's what, like, that's how I feel at this point, because DeRozan did not have a field goal. Like,
he didn't have a field goal in an entire postseason.
You don't pay DeMar DeRozan, you do not pay DeMar DeRozan max money for him to rebound. You don't pay him max money for him to defend. You don't pay him max money to be a playmaker. The only thing you pay DeMar DeRozan max money for is to score. Everything else is like a nice and tangible benefit. Like, oh, hey, he has some assists too. Oh, hey, he played some good defense for a while. Like, those are all like nice bonuses. But what you're buying with the money you spend on his contract is his ability to provide you with points. And he goes 0-for-8, does not score a field goal in a road game 3 in a split series.
Yeah, I mean, he got to the line a little bit. He got all his points at the line. But, like, I mean, the Bucks' defense is crazy. Like, DeRozan, the interesting thing about him is, like, the way his game has evolved over the past few years, it's like there have been defenders, like, specific guys who, like, one-on-one just used to be able to shut him down. And every summer he's, like, gotten a little bit better with his footwork, added some new moves to his package, like, and found ways that, even though like he always, like against like the Paul Georges and Jimmy Butlers and like Giannis Antetokounmpos of the world, like he gives up some inches, he doesn't have the longest wingspan, he can't just rise up over these guys and shoot, but the way he does it is sort of like the way that like Dwayne Wade does it, or like the way Kobe did it when they put like huge athletic guys on him, is like just fake guys out, use like a million pump fakes that he has, use his footwork, and like initiate contact and kind of do it with skill rather than just pure talent and athleticism. But like in this series, like all of those tricks that he's developed, all of the things that he's added to his game, it's like they're completely accounted for by these Milwaukee defenders. Like it just seems like, especially in that last game, he did not have an answer. Like I'm getting to the point where, like, I wrote this whole thing about the Raptors and how they need to pass the ball better and handle these traps, and I do think that still is going to be their main point of emphasis. But I'm getting to the point where I'm just looking at this Bucks defense and I'm saying, like, in the next game, like, do they even want to run much pick and roll? Is there even a point? Because the Bucks just swallow them up with multiple defenders, and the way they played in game 3, like, their recovery was really good too. Toronto helped them out by missing open shots on the perimeter as well. But like, would you rather have DeMar dribble into a side pick and roll a million times? Would you rather just him try to take Tony Snell one-on-one? And I think I'd rather just see him try to take Tony Snell one-on-one and forget all the normal parts of the Raptors offense, because it's just not working. Like, nothing is working.
I think I'd rather go back in time and trade him for someone who's actually good. That's what I would like to
do. Ooh, that's a hot take about an all-star.
All-star starter.
Yep. All-star starter.
Broke, like, was having a Jordan-type season to begin the season. Just unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, it is a hot take to say that he's just not good, but he was certainly not good.
He has not been
last night.
I will say he is not playoff good.
Weird though, because if you look, like, because of the way the Raptors play, like the way their offense is structured, like they kind of go how Lowry and DeRozan go, right?
Yeah.
And they're such a like hit or miss team But like when they win, those guys are usually good. It's not like either of them have like not had really good, high scoring, efficient playoff games. They both have, but they've also had really bad ones. And it's just hard for them to string consistent good performances together against playoff defense. Like we've seen this year after year. We see it sometimes in the course of the same game. He'll have a good half and they'll disappear.
One thing I've noticed with DeRozan, and this happened versus the Wizards and it happened versus the Nets, which is when you pressure DeRozan, when he brings the ball up court, when he's the guy that's going to like initiate the offense and you pressure him, he waits for you to stop. Like, he dribbles and he gets away from you and he pushes you off and then what he expects is for it to be like the regular season where guys are like, okay, well, I tried to get the steal and now we'll just play like normal regular season defense and I'll back up to the 3-point line and just wait for you to figure out what you're going to do. And the Bucks are like, no, we're staying on you the entire possession. We are going to attack you this entire time. You do not get to take a break and figure out what you want to do. We are going to defend you the entire time. And he looks really just like, he looks almost annoyed where he's like, well, stop it. No, like, let me figure out what I'm going to do. Stop. And it's like,
I mean, part of that is getting rid of the ball as soon as they overcommit. Right. And that's what like you and I have been talking about since before the series started. That's what Casey has been talking about. And that's honestly something that like he has gotten better at. You didn't really see it. And I thought the Bucks did a good job of closing off obvious passing lanes, as much as they could with regard to like their weak side defense. But I mean, we can talk X's and O's like as much as we want for this. Like the Bucks didn't change anything. Like what happened was they came out with an enormous amount of energy, and basically dominated the first few minutes of the game. And instead of like what we saw with the Cavs Pacers series where the Cavs like just took the initial punch and then made an enormous run, the Raptors just never changed. Like the Raptors just never got any semblance of momentum over the course of that game at all.
The thing I've read on most Raptors blogs today is like, well, you know, they win game four. It doesn't matter. Like, it's fine. Like, they just win game four. And I'm like, I mean, one.
Well, it's not just win game four. It's like they have to get out of the series.
Right. And
that's the thing. Like, no matter which way you slice it, as great as Milwaukee is, and I think there's a good argument to be made that we're watching the start of something really special with this Bucks team.
Yeah.
But, like, regardless, like, you don't put this kind of roster together with, like, 10 quality rotation players, with veterans as well as young guys, with, like, extra acquisitions made at the deadline specifically to help them compete for a conference championship. Like, you don't do all that for a team that loses in the first round. So I think there will be ways to, like, explain it away if they lose to the Bucks. Like, the Bucks were really good, and, like, the particular matchup wasn't favorable to Toronto, but like no matter like what you say, it's still going to be a failure for this roster. Absolutely. So it's not just about not getting embarrassed. It's not just about evening the series. That's all the Raptors can focus on right now. But I mean, they need to figure this thing out.
They need to figure this thing out. That is an accurate take. They need to figure this thing out. Jonas Valanciunas is almost like unplayable.
It's so frustrating, right?
Like, Thon Maker's been fantastic. Matthew Dellavedova was awesome. Tony Snell needs more credit. Like, Tony Snell...
I am a convert to Tony Snell. I was not a big fan of Chicago Bull Tony Snell, but he's doing the work.
I said in Chicago I thought he would be better than Jimmy Butler, and I may have missed the mark on that. But...
Yeah, just a little.
But the Bucks are 31 points better per 100 possessions with Tony Snell on the floor in the series. I mean, just their wings have destroyed Toronto. Destroyed. We'll have time, if they lose, to get into what's going to happen with Toronto after, except to say... People like Raptors fans are like, no, that come on, that's a hot take. I'm like, no. And including Bruce Arthur, who's amazing, by the way. Bruce Arthur said, made the same point that I did, which is this is the kind of loss that triggers massive changes for like this alters franchises, because Here's part of it. One of the reasons that teams tend to, like, GMs will keep their guys that they have success, even though you're like, but they're not that good, is because, like, they get an emotional attachment to the, like, they all go through the success together, right? And that builds, like, an emotional connection. But the same is also true of, like, these devastating losses. So, like, Masai Ujiri, who's a pretty methodical, logical, removed kind of guy, probably took this one pretty painfully. Like, to watch the team that he put together put out that performance in Game 3. So, again, we'll get all into this if they do lose, but I do not think that... Like, we are within range of being like, we need to start thinking about what happens to Toronto if they lose the series.
Yeah, I mean, all the questions are obvious. Like, what do you do if you're Kyle Lowry? Like, and you're entering free agency, and you have other, like, contenders that want you. Like, what do you do if you're Ujiri, and it's like, okay, we could give maxes to Lowry and Ibaka. Like Patterson's a free agent too. Like there are a bunch of questions here, and that's before we even get to the coaching staff, which I think everybody in Toronto is talking about as being like under a ton of pressure now. And every adjustment they make is going to be or don't make is going to be under the microscope for the rest of the series. And I think, I mean, there are several things that they could still do. Like I'm mystified that Tucker hasn't been in the starting five yet. I think you'll probably see a change there soon. I think they might even do something as drastic as putting Powell in the starting lineup. I think you could see Ibaka guarding Giannis. I think they should do whatever they can do to get DeRozan off of Middleton and just never have him guarding him. I think there's still a question of like how to best use Valanciunas, because I think it's like really obvious if you look at like some of the moments that he's had when he's had the ball with good post position. Like, he's obviously, like, capable of being a monster against this team, but he just hasn't been able to sustain it. He hasn't been able to hold his post position. He hasn't been able to, like, properly protect the basket on the other end. Like, he's been a net minus in the series. Like, I think that's very obvious, but it feels like it shouldn't have to be that way. So I think there's still, like, these questions of, like, how can they properly maximize, like, these, like, 10 guys that they have that are rotation caliber players, and, like, what can they do? And if they end up losing the series, then, like, there's going to be a bunch of questions about that in addition to all the questions about the roster. Like, it's just, it's a really weird time. But, like, at the same time, like, I want to reiterate, like, we were talking about these same things during the Pacers series last year, and they got through it. Like, it would be very Raptors to look like total trash and then to persevere and find a way and gut it out. Like, that's what happened in two different rounds last year, and that's just sort of part of who this team is. Like, I think as much as who the Cavs are is like come out and look like total trash and trail by like however much they trail by against the Pacers, and then just totally flip a switch and come back in that same game and dominate and look like the best team in the world. Like, it's very Raptors to look this bad for a full game and then still figure it out. So I'm not writing them off yet.
Rebuttal.
But I will say I was saying the same thing when they got swept by the Wizards as well. So
yeah. Yeah.
The worst is possible.
That'd be my say, is rebuttal. The actual most Wizards thing, or most Raptors thing, if we actually look back at history, is to lose in the first round to a team that they should not lose to. That is the most Raptors thing, actually, overall. You mentioned LeBron. I wrote that last night. Here's what's amazing. LeBron, in the second half, had 28-6-7. And I looked up all the different players who he had more points in the second half than they've had in the playoffs, more assists in the second half than they've had in the playoffs, more rebounds than they've had. Like, it's just insane. 28-6-7. He's averaging per 100 possessions in this series, 38 points, 11 rebounds, 12 assists on 55% from the field and 47% from three. Like,
I mean, and like, I don't know what more you want from him. Like, we can nitpick their defense and it's valid, but
he walked on the floor last night and just said, "We're winning this game, and there's nothing you can do about it." And it wasn't, "We're winning this game, me and my guys." It was, "I'm going to win this game, and it doesn't matter who you throw out with me. Deron Williams, Channing Frye, and Kyle Korver? Yep, we're going to put together a sub-80 per defensive rating, and we're going to light you up. That's what we're going to do."
Well, he was also setting those guys up for wide-open looks,
yep.
Right? Like, yep. And they were knocking them down.
Yep.
You know, the thing that stunned me was, like, again, I didn't see any of this live last night. So I knew, like, in broad strokes what happened. I knew the Pacers were up by a lot, and then LeBron went crazy. But what the shocking thing to me was how fast it happened. Like, There were 4 minutes left in the third quarter, and they were still down 20.
Yep.
And I was like, when is this comeback happening? Like, they cut into the lead a little bit, and then all of a sudden, there's a 10-0 run out of nowhere. And then a few minutes later, it was an 8-0 run, and they were within two. And it was just like, oh my God. It was very Warriors-like in the way that they put up points so quickly and just overwhelmed the other team to the point where they looked like they didn't know what to do. And they suddenly got tentative. They were suddenly making horrible decisions. And the Cavs just, it just looked easy for them.
At the 4:17 mark, they were up 19 with a 96.7 win probability, according to Inpredictable. At the 10:37 mark of the fourth, they were at 87.6. By the 4:55 mark, in a little under 5 minutes, their win percentage was down to 53.7, and then from there they were under. They did. At 4:31 is when they lost the lead. Like,
what you're saying is the Pacers blew a 3-1 lead.
Oh man, just you know. I read about Miles Turner yesterday and was like, where is this guy? Like, where is Miles Turner? And then he had an awesome first half.
Oh, he really did.
Thad Young had an awesome first half. Like, all of these guys had awesome first... And then in the second half, they just vanished. And I want to...
Lance even showed up and, like, hit his first two threes, I think. Like, yep. Everybody was playing well.
And I want to make this point, and this is important to me, because the narrative is going to become... I can already see it. It's going to be Paul George needs more help. Like, where were the Pacers for Paul George, who put up this great, great line in Game 3? And he did. He had a really good line in Game 3. Like, that, there's no denying that. He finished with 36 points, 15 rebounds, 9 assists, only 1 turnover. His game on paper looks incredible.
And he was a huge part of them building that lead, like the biggest part.
Yeah, yeah. But he was also playing in the flow of the offense. Like, he was, like, everybody, mm-hmm. everybody was eating in the first mm-hmm. half. Second half, 13 points, 6 rebounds, 4 assists. That's still a really good game. But 4 of 15 from the field. He took 15 shots, which is double anybody else.
Yeah.
And was a minus 29. Now, he was forcing it because he had to, and I get that. And you could say, like, nobody else was doing anything, but... Like, this is my only thing here is that it's going to get written, and when Paul George leaves this summer, when he's traded, it's going to get written that, like, his teammates weren't there for him. And I think that it was a collective failure in this one, not a one side or the other. Like, everybody was. Miles Turner was 0-7 in the second half. Like, he and Thad Young, Turner and Thad Young in the second half were 1-12. Like, you know, that is only.
There was a pass
that is only
George
slight,
made to Thad Young late in the game. Where, like, Paul George went, like, behind the back for his dribble on the perimeter, made, like, a bunch of different, like, juke moves to get to the basket, like, went up like he was going to shoot it, and then, like, wrapped his arm all the way, like, behind his defender and somehow threw a pass to the three-point line. And, like, Thad Young is wide open. Nobody near him, and he shoots a three that, like, hits the glass and then the rim. Like, that is just deflating.
Yeah. Just, you know, 1-12 for those two.
Yeah,
that's only slightly better than DeMar DeRozan. I mean, just absolutely, absolutely horrible. Late game, he didn't catch it. Just Memphis. I'm very interested in Game 4. I'm very interested in Game 4. And the reason I'm interested in Game 4 of this Grizzlies-Spurs series is I picked this one to go deep and thought that the Grizzlies could hang. And after the first one, I actually wasn't that rattled because I was like, Memphis tends to do this. They have clunkers in Game 1. And in the second,
I think we were both
game,
rattled after the second one, though.
I wasn't. I actually was like, I want to see, because my thing with game two was the Grizzlies came back. They had that thing down to I think 6 points.
Yeah.
And then they ran out of steam, and I'm like, I've seen this in playoff series enough where sometimes it carries over, and sometimes the other team delivers like the death blow. And instead, Memphis came out and just had more energy and out-executed them, and the Spurs really struggled. Tony Parker and Monte Ginobili were old and bad, and Mike Conley was terrific. Marc Gasol was terrific. Zach Randolph beasted Pau Gasol like he should every single time, and they got a big win. And so now it's, look, if the Spurs win Game 4, then we're looking at a gentleman's, and this thing is done. Like, it's over, because Memphis will deflate if they lose Game 4. But if Memphis wins Game 4, the Spurs are better lock in. Because if you give Memphis any sort of belief, they build on positive momentum. And they,
I think they have the belief right now.
Yeah. And
they have to.
Credit to David Fizdale, because even though I thought it was like a goofy move in terms of like how do these guys actually respond to the stuff like the
I loved it.
I loved it too. It was like, it's entertaining. I'm just like, does that really work? Apparently it does. And it got the town on his side, and it seemed like it created an emotional fire under the Grizzlies, which they need to play well, and is very hard to generate versus the Spurs.
I think that's the thing that we should have been talking about more than like how the players, like what the players' reaction is, like what it does for the town. Because, I mean, the coming off the two losses and the way they lost, I think they could have been just kind of like, ugh, like what is going on with this team? Like, right. What's going to happen in the summer? Blah, blah, blah. And instead they were just like fired the hell up.
Right.
And I think that's 100% because of Fizdale.
Okay. Three games on Friday night, and we'll kind of save the weekend reaction for Monday. Rajon Rondo is now out. He's out indefinitely with a fractured hand. I would bet.
Am I crazy to think that that matters a lot?
You are not. It's a huge thing. In fact, odds makers agree with you. This swung from Bulls -3 to Celtics -2 after the Rondo news came out. They are now favored in game three. Which is crazy that we're talking about this for the one seed. But anyway,
I know.
But look, I went back and I watched every single offensive rebound that the Bulls have gotten in the series, and I broke it down, and there's a column on CBS Sports that you can read. And what I found was Isaiah Thomas versus Rajon Rondo is a huge problem, or was a huge problem for the Boston Celtics.
Rondo always crashed.
Always. And
Isaiah is not used to, like, he doesn't ever compete for rebounds. It's just not part of his thing.
And he doesn't try. And I don't blame him for not trying. Because I think part of his whole thing is like, look, man, I'm not going to get it. Like, I'm just not going to get this rebound. Like, that is not. He tried once versus Robin Lopez and had it, and then he couldn't quite grab it because he jumped up and his hands reached up and he wasn't quite tall enough. And Robin just like from behind grabbed it from him and tapped it in. So without him now, and the other thing is, I noticed this several times. I've noticed this the whole year. The Celtics are spooked whenever Isaiah is in single coverage, especially in the post, but overall. They are always inching over because they're worried about him getting burned or bodied. Like, Horford helped over about four times, and what happened was he would help over and take himself out of position. The guy guarding Rondo, or the guy Thomas was guarding, would shoot, and then whoever Al Horford was supposed to be blocking out, that guy got the rebound and put it back. And now, I commented this morning that probably goes away. Trey Curry was like, well, MCW is big enough. He can probably do that in the same. I was like, yeah, but I don't think he's going to get the ball. Like, Jimmy Butler and Dwayne Wade are not going to be like, yes, MCW, feel free to go in the post, even though he's got a mismatch. So I think, honestly, the Bulls have to go big. Like, they've got to go to Jimmy Butler and, like, I would not be opposed to going to a point guardless lineup. Like, just Jimmy.
What? Jimmy is a point guard. Right. Like, to me, either of those guys are basically point guards.
Yeah. So Jimmy Butler and Dwayne Wade should be like Butler, Wade, Nico at the three.
Yeah.
Because you need the – or Zipser. You can put Zipser in there. And then Nico.
Yeah, I think you want Zipser and Nico, like, preferably together.
Yeah.
But, look, I think, like, Grant's obviously going to play. MCW, I think you'll see at least a few minutes for him, but I don't think they necessarily just have to give all of Rondo's minutes to point guards, right? But the question is, how many minutes can Wade handle? And how many minutes, honestly, can Butler handle? He's already playing like 42 minutes in these games. Like, I don't know how much more you can squeeze out of him.
Yeah. I think this evens things. I really do. I think I think the Celtics win game three, and then game four is what it's going to come down to. If the Bulls lose both of them at home, then the Celtics have this thing back under control, and it's where they need it to be. They can win two out of three at home, I think. This is a huge injury, and it really does swing things. I think that Isaiah will be more settled after the funeral.
Yeah.
I think
he's great. His defense against Isaiah, and Isaiah did well offensively despite it, but I think this makes his life easier.
Right. And, you know, he's obviously still grieving, but I just think that he'll be in a better – I think he and the team will be in a better place emotionally. They'll take out their frustrations. They'll take out their energy. They'll push, and I think that they'll get this win. And then it comes down to game four. And I think the Bulls, I think game four is going to be massive because I think the Bulls are probably going to bring it then too. Cause they'll know the opportunity that they'll have.
Yeah.
We are so close.
Game four is in any series that isn't 3-0 are always like super intense and like sometimes like uglier than you'd expect, but always those are the big ones.
I do have to say we are definitely looking at, someone's coming back from down 3-1 in the first round.
You're calling it?
Look, we had one in 2015. We had two in 2016. It's only right that we continue the trend. Like, we are in the age of 3-1 comebacks. So, right. I think either the Raptors or the Bulls, or the Celtics rather, are coming back from down 3-1. That's gonna happen. So I'll take Boston.
What about not the Hawks?
No. I'll take the Celtics -2 tonight. Who you got?
Yeah, I got Boston.
OKC is favored by 2 versus Houston in game 3.
I understand why they're favored, and like I want them to win for the sake of this being like interesting, but I think I'm gonna go with Houston.
I'm taking OKC.
I hope you're right.
I think they win, but I think this one's going deep. I think this is gonna be one of those series where we think one thing after two games, and then it turns into a long series. Like, these two teams are just. Part of my thing is I'm just like, these two teams are too close in terms of what they did in the regular season. Like, Houston's significantly better, but they're not so much better that's like this massive gap. Like, OKC was a good team, and good teams should win at least one at home. They're going to get this one. We'll see if they can get...
Like, still reeling from watching the fourth quarter of that last game, and I'm just like,
Someone, you know, when I was covering Thunder Spurs, Royce Young, who used to work at CBS and now is a great writer at ESPN, Royce would comment to me after Russ would have like a bad game. Like, I would be like, yeah, but he only had like 2 assists. And then like very subtly Royce would be like, I bet you anything that Russ has double digits to assist tonight. Or like Russ would shoot. Oh, like wouldn't shoot. He was only have like 8 shots. He'd be like, I bet he goes off for 30 points tonight. And it would happen. Yeah. Like Russ adapts. He overcorrects to whatever the previous game was. And
if the lineup's correct too, like if he has more, like if they give more minutes to like, McDermott, even like Singler, maybe if they just have more shooting out there, like I think you'll see the assist numbers rise pretty quickly.
Right. And finally the Clippers. I don't really have a feel for the series yet. I still don't. The Clippers are favored by only 1.5 in Utah without Gobert, which is interesting.
Oh, that's such a. I just wanted to coin flip all of these Utah. Yeah. Los Angeles games.
I would stay away from this one.
Yeah, if I have to pick, I'll take Utah because they're home. But I don't know.
It's tough. This one's gonna be more interesting after game. Like, I'll have a better feel for the series after we get to 4 games. Because, and part of that's because I'm kind of wondering, like, you know, if Gobert does not get back, which it doesn't look like he's going to, the Clippers might be able to just go up 3-1 and be done. Like, they might be able to win 3, take both in Utah. And if they do that, then you know, and it would be very. We talk about things that are very Raptors. It would be very Clippers to do that, to like lose the first one. Everyone's like, "Here we go again. Clippers can't do anything right. Absolutely horrible." And then actually winds up where like the Clippers like very quietly like, "Oh no, they won the next 3," and then they wind up winning the series. So that'll be interesting.
I want a big Rodney Hood game. That's what I want. I want him to just be like, "I'm bigger than all your wings." And I'm going to run pick and rolls and just shoot open slash like lightly contested shots. And I don't know if he's fully healthy yet. I don't think he is. But I want to see him have a breakout because I think he's still super underrated and like he doesn't have the usage of some of the other guys in that team. But I think that's an advantage they have there if they decide to focus on it.
Excellent. All right. That's James Herbert. I hope everybody has a great weekend. Enjoy all 8 games. This is our last 8-game playoff weekend in the NBA. After this, we're going to be down to only 2 games a night. So, and make sure to enjoy it.
Go so quickly.
Make sure to enjoy it. And one way or another, we're going to have a lot to talk about on Monday.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.